Welcome to episode 42 of the Legal Moves podcast. It's exciting. It's the best number, right? This is Zachary Strebeck, your host and the resident game lawyer. Today, I am talking to game developer Jeremy Commander. Welcome back to the show, Jeremy.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while. You were on before, I think, with Brian, right? With Brian Hank.
Yeah, I was on with Brian and Richard, and we do a podcast together called the Board Game Business Podcast.
Yep.
And so we were on to ask. I was on before Brian.
Yeah.
And then you were on that one. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. It's our third conversation as a podcast. Confusing.
Yeah. Well, so in case people didn't hear you on the last episode here, why don't you give us a little background about you? Where are you from? How'd you get into the games industry? All that.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm from the Bay Area, California, and I used to be like a competitive TCG player, and I would go travel the country and play the circuit and play TCGs. And that's what developed my interest in games and gamings in general. And then I decided I really didn't want to spend the time and money it takes to be a competitive TCG player, because it's a big investment to stay sharp enough to compete. Yeah. And I just wanted to have fun. So my TCG buddies had introduced me to board games, and you know, my impression of board games was like Monopoly, like most people, like, board games are terrible. Why would I want to play those? And they're like, no, there's this whole thing. There's like these Euro style board games. They're much better than the games you remember from your childhood. You should try these out. So I went to a board game party at my buddy's place. He was a graduate student at Stanford at the time. And I played Ticket to Ride and Puerto Rico. And those are, you know, two like top 50 games on BGG. I was like, wow, these games are really good. This is not what I expected at all. And then maybe a couple of years after that, I had done some design work on TCGs as well. I'm credited on a few TCGs for different things or expansions. I said, well, let me see if I can make a game, because I really wanted to do a couple different things with a game that hadn't been done before. And so I started doing it for fun. And one of my friends from the TCG space, Franklin Kenter, he's a math professor. He has a PhD in math and he teaches math. He's like, well, I'm working on some games too. And we had each done some stuff on our own. And we said, let's work on some together. And the ones we worked on together turned out much better than the ones we worked on our own. So now we do all of our games together as like a development partnership. And so far, we've signed 4 board games to different publishers. And we have a 5th one that's like awaiting review right now. So that, and it's a fun hobby. We enjoy it a lot. You know, it gets me an excuse to go to Gen Con and other places and play more games. And so I'm having a blast. And I also organize a prototype board game convention out here in California. I organize Protospiel San Jose. We just had our 3rd annual Protospiel San Jose. And we had our biggest turnout yet. We had 500 people come to play prototype board games for 3 days, making it the biggest Protospiel in the country. And so, like, wow. And there's a lot of people who are hungry to play more games. And there's lots of people out there designing their own game. We had 75 designers bring various game designs. And so I'm having a blast.
Right. You even had such gaming luminaries as myself show up.
You did.
Yeah.
You were there. And I had a bunch of publishers and game companies and lots of game designers you've heard of and games you've played working on their new stuff. And it's a great time, because I really like the spirit of community there, because we're all there to try to make each other's games better. The whole point is to go, you play other designers' games, you give them feedback, they play your games, give you feedback, and we're all trying to make better games.
Right.
The board game hobby has been growing by 15-20% for the last 5 years. And there's also a lot of crummy games out there, though. And if too many people play too many crummy games, they'll get turned off on trying new board games. So if we can all help each other make better games, let's continue to expand and grow the hobby.
Yep, it's awesome. Yeah, what you were saying before reminded me of before I got into these designer board games, I was studying how to play Scrabble really well, I think.
Oh, there we go.
Memorizing word lists and things like that, like all the two-letter words and all that nonsense. And I'm glad these games are much more fun than that. That seems like work. It doesn't seem
it is
fun
work.
Game. Yeah.
I think to play just about any game at that, like, that national or international competitive level, it becomes work. You have to invest so much time and effort and mental energy in it, and you have to learn different games. So in Scrabble, you got to learn and memorize all these words.
Yep.
In different games, you've got to learn to calculate the odds or probabilities in your head. You got to go, okay, I've seen these cards of his, I've seen these cards of mine. I know my deck contains this. Should I try this now or should I wait? And then you have to like do the math and calculate the probabilities in your head to make the decision. Or in poker, you got to know the odds of the different hands. And so it does very much become more work to play at that level.
Yeah, same with, I used to count cards on a very low level in blackjack as well. And it's another one where it just sucks all the fun out of the game and you don't really make that much money. So yeah, it's really not worth it. All right. So yeah, I actually met Franklin as well at the Pokerspiel event, and he was a very cool guy. So that's awesome. It's great that you guys are a team. So let's talk about that for a second, because I know that you have developed things solo, like Booze Barons, correct?
Yeah.
How does that work? Does he get jealous if you're developing your own game, or are you guys free to do everything you want on your own as well?
No, we're free to do stuff on our own. I started Booze Barons before we started our partnership in earnest. Okay. And he had his couple titles that he had started beforehand as well. And Booze Barons was close to being done before we started doing stuff. And so I said, well, do you want to work on it with me and get credit as a co-designer? And he's like, nah, you know, it's at this point, it's very late in the process and it's really your thing. Just finish it and make it yours. And that's, I'm like, that's fine. And so that's what we wound up doing.
Very cool. So today's big topic is going to be something that we discussed a bit at the Pokerspiel event, playtesting your games, right? So this will probably focus more on tabletop games because that's your thing. But I think this extends to pretty much all kinds of games, these kind of topics, right? Jeremy, why don't you first tell me, how does a typical playtest for one of your games go? What's the process like?
Depends where in the development cycle the game is. If the game is very early and very rough, then I probably want to play it with other game designers or people I play with games all the time that know me well. Because early on, you know, if the first couple times the game hits the table, it's probably going to be terrible and have lots of big glaring problems and issues. And so you want people you have a very good relationship with playing that game that will give you honest feedback and won't be upset that, you know, the game might just be a total disaster. If it's a kind of a mid-development game, now I want to play it with as many different groups and as many different people as possible. And I'm probably going to just teach them the rules and then have them play. And it's mostly more useful for me not to play and just to observe the game and see what people are doing. Sometimes to make the players even, if we're trying to test a particular thing, I may play as well to get the feeling for how the things are going. And if it's a late stage game, now I may ask people to read the rules and play on their own and try to find people who have never played the game before and see if they can do a blind play test where they can read the rules, play the game and understand it without any input from me. And that's kind of a general overview of the play test cycle for a board game as how I would do things.
So how early in the process, when do you get the feeling that it's time to get other people involved, even if it's just friends and family and or partners, things like that?
Generally, the process that I'll use with my design partner is we'll write an outline or like a treatment for a game and send it to the other one. And the design partner reviews it and just kind of rates it. And we kind of have like, oh, this looks really, really good. We should do this next. You know, next time we start a new game, this should be one of the ones we start.
Right.
Or versus, this is okay. Let's put it in the file. Maybe we'll come back to it. I don't know. Versus at the very bottom, like, no, I hate this. I don't want to work on this. It's not worth the time. And then when we start a game, one of us will then take the outline and then try to build a prototype. So we'll lay out all the cards and find some clip art and put it in there and write real rules that a real human could read, and then build out the prototype, send it to the other design partner who may do another pass and clean it up, like an edit cleanup pass. Mm-hmm. And then we'll print it out and try it right away with people we know. Because you'll be playing it. I don't think most games, I don't play a solo game first. Like I play myself. I don't do that in most cases.
Okay.
If I had a co-op game, I could certainly do that. But a lot of games, you really need to see, because people will often just ignore what you think is the primary strategy and do something totally different.
Sure.
And you can't tell that until you have a human that's not you play the game.
Right. Do you find that having a partner is the best thing? Like for, let's say you're a new designer. Is it sort of an invaluable thing to have that person that's sort of always there that you could bounce the ideas off of?
It is useful. I see like Luke Laurie does a lot of stuff with Tom Jolly now and Matt Riddle and Ben Pitchback, and you see different design partners in the industry. And I think the main advantage you get there is you design a game in your head and you have an idea of how it's going to work and how it's going to play.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in your head and your own biases prevent you from seeing certain possibilities or how other people will perceive it. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a design partner, immediately you have a different brain look at that game and go, I don't understand this part. How does this part work? Or yep. No one's going to play this part. I think you think it's good, but it's not good for this reason. And just having an independent mind look at that will immediately make the game better even before it hits the table for the first time. And in our case, we're in different states. And so we collaborate online and we use Dropbox and phone calls and things like that. And so I can play a game and then I can send a copy of something to Franklin, who has yet to play that version of the game or that. And he can play it out there. And it's almost like a remote blind play test as they're right. playing it for the first time. And we can go back and forth. If one of us is stuck, the other one can work on it for a while. And that creates all kinds of advantages.
Now, are you sort of harsh with your criticism of each other's games? I mean, is there yes. no holds barred, I guess?
Yes. Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think for a lot of people that start their first board game, they're only working on one board game. And that board game is their baby, right? Like, oh, I have this idea for, I'm going to do a game about a snowplow, you know, and you're still plowing streets. And I really wanted, this is my passion to make a game about this. And you're working on it, and maybe, you know, a lot of game ideas aren't very good. They're just mediocre and some of them are terrible.
Sure.
And, odds are that game will fall in the mediocre, area. It's just a mediocre game. It's not terrible, but it's not great either. And if it's your only game and it's your passion project, you're going to be so wound up in like, oh, I got to get this game to work. I got to get this to work. So we try to work on multiple games at once. And if a game isn't working, we'll kill it. It'll get shelved. Or we'll put it on like life support. Like this game gets one more test. And if that next test isn't good, it goes on the shelf. And that we move on and spend our valuable time on a different game or a different idea. To make sure that the mediocre games don't burn up all of our time. And we're looking for what's really a good game.
I agree. That's that's great advice, I think, having multiple games. Because, I mean, for all the reasons that you pointed out, but how often do you find yourself going back to those ones that you've shelved and maybe thought you would never come back to? Maybe you just say, you know what, that's a great theme, but maybe the whole game was totally wrong or something like that.
Yeah, once in a while. We had a poker game mm-hmm. we made. It was a competitive poker hand game with a Western theme. Mm-hmm. And it won an award in a contest. And it's a 54-card game. So you play that plus a deck of cards. It's super cheap to produce. And we got no publisher interest. We shopped it around some publishers. We got a little bit of interest, but not much. And we found as we explored it further that the poker hands are too hard for people to understand, especially in a competitive game. Some people will be much better at poker than other people, and they will make the game very lopsided. So then maybe, I don't know, a year after we shelved that one, we're like, well, what if it was a co-op game? Because they're looking for a co-op game. What if we take that and make it a co-op game? Because then it doesn't matter if someone's knowledge of poker is better than someone else, because we're all playing against the game. And we tested a co-op version, but it was still mediocre, so back on the shelf it went. So I'd say some of the games do get revisited, and when we have a new idea or a new way of doing them, a lot of the ones, most of the ones that go to the shelf probably stay there for good. But who knows?
They were there for a reason, right?
They were there for a reason. Who years? Yeah. Maybe years later, there'll be some new mechanic or some new idea we come across. Like, oh, that would be a perfect fit for so-and-so game, and we could revive that with this new mechanic, and that might have it turn the corner.
Do you keep all this stuff organized in some way? Do you keep a big spreadsheet of all your game ideas or something like that? Or is a literal shelf where you put these printouts?
Both. Okay. Yeah. So we have an electronic shelf, like in Dropbox, a folder of game ideas, the outlines, and then of previous games that have been shelved. And that includes all their files for all their components. So it's really the complete print and play in that folder. And then I have a physical shelf that holds the boxes of the games that are on the shelf.
Right. And so going back to the harsh criticism thing, do you think it's a mistake to use people that are very familiar with you, like friends and family, for playtesting in the beginning? Should you never playtest with friends and family, or should you sort of just go into it with the mindset that they are not going to tell you any negative things about your game?
That's a great question. It depends on who you're testing with. So, if you're testing with your brother and your best buddy, they may not want to hurt your feelings. They may hold back their criticism. We try to test with people who are our friends, but we game with all the time. And we've tried to, over the years, encourage them to give negative feedback, because that's the only way the game's going to get better. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these people won't hold back. They'll just say, that was terrible. And they'll tell us straight up. And that's what that early game needs to get better. So it really depends on the person. And so we just to do feedback, I like to ask two questions. I like to ask, what did you like about the game and what would you change? And people who are hesitant to give feedback will at least say, oh, I like this and I like that. And that tells you where the fun is in the game or things I probably shouldn't change too much.
Right.
Like, well, I would change this because that was hard to understand or that. And I'm asking them to change something, even if they're not going to say this is terrible. If everybody says they'd want to change something, then that was terrible. No one liked that mechanic or that part of the game. And then I'll try to ask some, what I'm trying to do more of is negative leading questions. To ask negative leading questions. Did the game take too long? Was this part too boring? Was this part too complicated? And I'm looking for a negative answer. I'm trying to lead that negative leading questions to try to dig out some more feedback for the game.
Interesting. It's a good technique. Because for me personally, and I remember when we play tested a couple of bigger, smaller games at a Protospiel, and I'm hesitant to say anything negative because I did generally have a fun time playing everything, but it's hard for me to to give negative feedback to people that I know, right? And so this is the problem. Even if you, but I think maybe you had asked some negative leading questions that led me to say some things that maybe weren't so positive, but I don't know.
And that was useful. One of those games that you played is now signed with a publisher, and the other one Excellent. Went to the shelf. And that's probably where they both deserve to go.
Yeah, if they're the ones, if they're the ones I remember, then yeah, I believe that they went in the right spots. Yeah, no offense, but
no, that's all right. No, that's the way it works out. I think in your line of work too, you have to be more cautious about the negative feedback you give the people you're talking to because they may not be so receptive to it. Sure. They're already struggling with something and they're coming to you for hopefully positive advice or conversation.
Yeah, but they also want a sort of neutral view of the situation, right? I mean, exactly. Definitely it doesn't do my clients any favors if I tell them that everything's great when it's not, right?
Yeah. You'd be realistic. Okay.
Yeah. Well, but on the other end, you know, when you're working with another side, the other side, let's say you're negotiating a contract or something like that, you have to be cognizant of the fact that if you go back and change everything about the contract, it's too much and it'll probably just kill the entire deal, right?
They're just going to
walk away and say, man, forget it. So you really have to choose your battles there and just pick the ones that are actually important. How do you organize all this feedback that you get? Do you like have a form that people fill out or do you just keep it all in your head or what do you
I tried paper forms and I used paper forms for a while and I would use paper forms again for a late stage game. So a game that's nearing completion and I'm doing remote blind play tests, the paper forms are useful. People tell you the truth more on a paper form than they do verbally to your face. So they'll write, you know, on a score of one, especially to make the forms anonymous. You don't put your name on the form. So, but some mistakes I see designers have is they have their feedback form like, oh, when the game goes at Kickstarter, if you'd like to be contacted, put your email here. I think that's a mistake. You should have your feedback form separate and your email signup list as a different piece of paper. And that way people can be anonymous and be very honest with their feedback. And if you ask them to rate different things in the game, how is the play length? How is the complexity? How is the amount of luck? And they have to rank on a scale of 1 to 5 and you get ones and stuff. Then you say, oh, it's clearly this part of the game is not working. So that paper feedback can be useful. Unpub.net has a wonderful PDF feedback form you can get and use that to test your game with. And they also have an app on iOS where people can electronically fill out feedback and it goes right into your apps. If you register your game with Unpub, your game gets a listing in their database. And so I can actually hand someone my phone or iPad and they could anonymously put in feedback for the game and that gets posted into the database entry for my game in Unpub.
Cool.
And so that can be very useful. I don't do that much of that anymore. Late stage, I will. Now when I do remote blind playtesting, I'll ask for written feedback and I'll get some of that as well. In the early and mid stages, we mostly do audio recordings. So at the end of the feedback, then we'll put out a smartphone with a voice recorder and just ask people the questions. What did you like? What did you change? And then the negative leading follow-up questions to try to draw out the feedback. And then I'll send that audio feedback to my design partner and vice versa. And the opposite person will listen to it. And so if we're in different states, you know, I wasn't in the room. I wasn't at the test. And now I can hopefully have a more objective analysis listening to the feedback where I have no direct emotional involvement and I can hear people's voices and their tone of voice and what they said and evaluate the feedback based on that.
Yeah, hearing it straight from their voice, I think you can pick up a lot of more the intonation that will probably give you more than just the handwriting on the piece of paper, right? if they're right. saying it with scorn or with sarcasm, you know, this is it.
Yeah. Or a lot of designers are like, oh, I'll remember the feedback. And you go to like a protospiel or a con and you play your game a bazillion times and tons of people talk. You cannot remember all of that.
Definitely.
And you can't write the as fast as people can talk. So the audio record really gives you the chance to replay it later and go, oh, yeah, he said so-and-so, and this guy had a good idea to how to fix this. And that's really a good way to archive that feedback and review it.
Yep. So you mentioned remote blind playtesting. Does the Unpub site allow you to do that, like put up a print and play PDFs or something like that?
No, you can have a public game or a hidden game. Uh-huh. They don't have to my knowledge, there's not a mechanic to remote blind, but for that, I either pay a service.
Okay.
So, like, there's a service called Game Crackers, and there's another one that Kiva runs. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I could send you for the show notes.
Sure.
And then you mail them a copy of the game and you pay a nominal fee and they do remote blind playtesting and they do this all the time. Oh, I'm sorry. My other phone is going off.
That's fine.
I've been taking care of my parents' house because my dad had a heart surgery this week.
Mm.
So they're up at the hospital. So I'm taking care of the house. And apparently they have their phone set to ring like 11 times before it goes to voicemail because it's just going and going and going.
Well, when I stay at my parents' house, it boggles my mind how many phone calls they get during the day. I mean, I never get it. No one calls me. I get text messages and things like that, but they are getting calls every 15, 20 minutes. It makes me crazy.
It's a generational thing. That generation calls. They don't text, right?
Yep.
And so I could understand that. So let me ask you a question. Your question was about remote blind playtesting and what opportunities are there to do that. And so there are remote blind playtesting services like Game Crackers. They're like gamecrackers.com. Or one that Kiva runs, where you can mail them a copy of the game, you pay a nominal fee, and they do this often. So they're pretty good at giving you a remote blind playtest. They'll read your rules, give you feedback on your rules, they'll send you an audio recording, they'll send you written notes of your game, and that's useful. Sometimes I'll also do remote blind playtesting for buddies I know from the TCG days that have now moved to other areas of the country. And so I'll say, hey, can I mail you a copy of this game? And I'll mail you if they're still playing the TCG, some packs for that game or some promo cards, or I'll mail you some money so you guys can buy pizza, and, you know, get your crew together, play the game, record some feedback for me, and let me know what you think. And that can be useful too. So I'll mail a copy of the game out to somebody. Maybe I'll subsidize their pizza for that night. They get together, they play the game, they eat the pizza, and then they send me some feedback. And that's been very useful as well. So the late stage games, I'll try to send out to several groups like that and get several remote blind play tests. It's especially helpful for refining your rules. And generally, rules in the board game industry have tremendous opportunity to be better. And so it's great for trying to improve your rules.
Yep.
Yeah, there's so many bad rules.
Yep. So the blind part of remote blind testing, it means you're not there, or it means that they don't know you. I guess I'm confused on that.
The blind means they've never played the game before. They're playing it cold. So a blind play test is someone reads the rules and plays the game for the first time.
Okay.
And so that they, you know, you're not explaining it to them. They haven't played before. They have no prior knowledge of the game or how it works. Mm. And that's a good test of your rules because that's how, when your game hits retail, it's someone's going to experience it. They may buy your game, open it up, read the rules, and play it. If they have a friend who's played before and can teach them, great. But often that doesn't happen. And so what is that experience like? Does it take forever to read the rules? Are people confused by certain things and do them wrong? And so it's very useful to do that. And then remote blind play test. So blind play test, you do the local one, you go in the other room, they read the rules and play. And maybe you leave the voice recorder there or something like that. You come back and watch them after they read the rules. But then you can still bias the test. So remote test is you're not even physically in that building. You're not at that location. You send it off somewhere and I mail it to another state or whatever, and then you get very objective feedback about how the game is doing.
And so the feedback you get is just something that they're talking about afterwards or something? Or are you having them keep a phone out and record the whole gameplay with a video or something like that? I know
I've done all of the above.
Okay.
I've done all of the above. Depends on the game. So some games, I want to hear people play the game with audio during the game. And so I'll ask them to record audio during the game, and I'll listen to that. Other games, I just need the feedback at the end. And especially if I'm just trying to see if, you know, are the rules good? Do people... So I know this game is fun. I know it works. Can people read the rules and play, and do they have a good experience? And then maybe I just need the feedback at the end. Are there any issues that came up for the remote player that I haven't experienced yet in my playtests?
Right. So there's, I mean, you mainly work in tabletop games, but I know that with software, you also help teach software, right? That's your day job?
My day job is a software trainer. I teach people how to use different software packages and different software programs.
Yeah. Do you use like eye tracking or heat maps or any of that kind of stuff, like where their mouse is going, that kind of thing in that?
No. So my job's a little unusual is that 100% of the training I do is face-to-face.
Okay.
Mostly like in a classroom setting. And so I'm live and seeing them face-to-face what they're doing. So that, I know that's unusual.
Right.
I have participated in programs like that in the past. Occasionally I'll get borrowed to help other teams who do that, mm-hmm. but that's not the area that I currently work in. This has been a great boon for board games as some of the feedback systems we use to test how people have learned, mm-hmm. I apply to board games. And in sense that I will do face-to-face in my day job, doing it all face-to-face in board games fits very well.
So what are the big lessons you've drawn from your... Do you want to divulge these trade secrets of yours? Or it'd be nice to know some of the big lessons of how to teach a game, right? How to structure your rules maybe so that they're most effective. Those kind of topics I think are interesting.
So I think that it's best, a really easy mistake to make is it's best to write your rules like in a first person. Like on your turn, you can do the following three things. Right. You could do this. Instead of on a player's turn, the player may choose from the following options.
Yep.
And that first person immediately makes it more engaging and useful. And so in the written rules, I try to always have it be first person like that. You don't want to do too many edge cases and side notes. You know, that you can put in the back of the rules or in a glossary or appendix or on the geek. You really want to give people just the basics to get going and playing the game. I'm not a fan of rules where it's like, oh, okay, this is the battle phase, and here is how you would have a battle. Now we're going to talk about how it happened if you have a ranged battle. Now if you how to modify it as a sea battle. Like, I just want to understand how to have a battle and move on. Hmm. And then when I have a sea battle or a ranged battle, I can look that up in the rules. I don't want to, like, you know, send an extra 5 minutes here reading all the different branches of this particular scenario. I want to make it very, very straightforward.
Okay.
The other thing, if you want to do it possible, is have people discover things on their own. For adults, you want to do what you call lead learning out, where you are giving them a clue or a hint to have them figure something out on their own. You don't want to spell it out for them. You don't want to do it for them, because adults find that to be a turnoff. And if they kind of discover that themselves, if I've just set them up with a hint or a point in the right direction, mm-hmm. and then they organically experience that during the game or figure it out on their own, that little aha moment is very exciting and very rewarding. And so you want to try to create those if you can.
Can you give me an example of how that would work, like in game rules, for instance?
How would I do that in game rules?
Or do you mean in the game itself, right? Like you're giving them opportunities.
You want to do it in both. It's much harder to do it in rules than than in the game. If you could have a card or a mechanic in the game that creates the little aha moment, mm-hmm. then that's really fun. But if you could do it in the rules, that's better. But that's even hard. That's very hard to do. I try to think of a good example where I might do that. Yeah, so there's a game, you play a protospiel, Pirate 21, mm-hmm. and there's a card in that called the King, and the King is the I win card. But it doesn't explicitly say that right off the bat, so much as that you get this card and it says, oh, okay, if you could pull this off, if you could get your hand to be exactly 21 and win the round without anybody tying you, you win the whole game, not just the hand. And initially, people look at that, and they may or may not understand how that works. Or like, oh, wait a minute. And then they start to play with the king, and they start to see, oh, okay, so what I really want to do is I want to get the king, and another card that supports it lets me change my hand out. Hmm. And because the number on the king is this, that these are the numbers I'm looking for to make my strategy work to try to pull it off. And then they kind of have this little aha moment, and they can pursue that and try to win that way, and that can be a lot of fun. And it didn't say, oh, you know, if you collect these numbers, you win. Or if you do this exact strategy, you win.
Yeah.
It's implied, and you have to figure it out yourself.
That makes sense. I mean, even something in the rules, just discussing the cards and, you know, that they could be combined in different ways and you have to discover it on your own or something like that, just to sort of give them a taste of the fact that it could buy, you know, that could be a thing that you do. I don't know.
Or I'm working on a co-op game, mm-hmm. and the co-op game, so you play an attack card and it's a reckless punch and it gives you some power, mm-hmm. but it also says, you know, at the end of this fight, you're going to have to discard a card from your hand, and cards in hand are like the resource in this game.
Okay.
And so like, okay, I got this, let's get this powerful punch, but it's reckless. So I'm going to discard a card, get my hand. And then in the game, you learn new fight moves. And so one of the ones you learn is, like, I have your back or something like that. It's a different move. I can't remember what the title is right now. And what it says is, if another player plays a reckless move and you play this, cancel any penalty from that reckless move. And right. So now you're immediately taught someone how to make a two card combo. And combo cards together.
Yep.
And you want to have that organic experience where someone goes, oh, these cards combo. I should be looking for how I can chain them together. And the goal of this game is to make a co-op game that takes some mechanics from TCGs and puts it in a really simple package, like a Munchkin level package for people who have never played that style of games before. And it kind of teaches them how to do that kind of stuff.
Very cool. Yeah. I mean, that's a perfect example, actually. So you did it. You did it. So you talked about sending out materials for remote playtesting. Do you get prototypes made? Or are you sending out PDFs? Or how are you sending these to them?
Yeah, so I've done it where, like, you know, I send someone a PDF and they print it out, cut it up, and make it. And you know, I ask someone to work for free or for very little,
right?
And the odds that they get around to doing that are, you know, somewhat low. And then I said, okay, well, I'll print it all out for you, and you just have to assemble it on your end. And that works a little better, and people tend to follow through more. And so now what I do is, no, I'll make the full game. So I'll print it all out, I'll cut it all up, I'll make all the pieces, mm-hmm. I'll put it in an actual box. I actually make a box for all the prototype games, too. They have a box cover, and they have a box back, and the box backs explains the game. I started doing that when I was going to Protospiel events, and I wanted to have people come to my table. Like, hey, you can choose what game you want to play.
Yeah.
Here are the boxes. Yes. Pick it up, look at the box back, like, and say, oh,
yep.
Okay. And it tells you the play time and the number of players and the style of the game. And mm-hmm. so I wanted to appeal to that player. I'm using their time. I wanted to make the experience as good as possible for them. And so then I'll mail my remote playmaster. It comes in a box with, you know, with a cover and a back and the rules and everything. And then some sort of reward or thank you. It's a gift card or whatever that's in there. And so now there's a higher level of motivation to, like, oh, I need to get this. I need to have people over and get this done, or take it to my game group and get it to the table, because it's ready to go. And I have a thank you gift I've already in my hands. And that's much more likely to happen for people to follow through.
So when you go to these Protospiel type events, do you find that the regular players or the designers are the better ones to have playing your games? Or are they both great for different reasons? That's sort of a cop-out answer, but I guess that's...
It's definitely the designers. Okay. It's definitely the designers, yeah. So the feedback you'll get from another designer, especially another designer who has made a couple games or been around for a while or been to a few prototypes, it's going to be worth like five normal people playing your game. Because they're going to understand different mechanics. They're going to understand player decisions. They're going to understand how these seven different things make people feel. Mm-hmm. And they're going to give you very, hopefully, very pointed feedback about that. Like, this made people feel bad. This mechanic won't work because it creates loss aversion. And people will never take the risk because the loss aversion will prevent them from making that move. So you need to lower the penalty or make the reward greater. Otherwise, that's not going to work. And you get very good feedback. The problem is, I went to some Protospiels. I went to Protospiels Prime in Michigan. It was like 90% game designers and, you know, 10%, maybe 5% publishers and 5% players. Uh-huh. And so if you want to get a game to the table, you know, you're sitting around on a table and it's four designers there and they all want to have their game get to the table.
Right.
So the proper etiquette is that you play three other people's games for every one of yours you get to the table.
Right.
And that's useful, and that's the way it works most of the time. And then you're going to get feedback from three other designers on your game when you do get to the table. But it also means you only get to the table relatively few number of times.
Right.
So for my event, I try to draw in a lot of players, and my goal is not to make it so you don't have other designers play your game. Quite the opposite. I really want designers to play each other's games, and so I structured the event so every designer has a tag table. meaning that they only get to use the table for half of the time over the weekends. Yep. And some designers decided to take that literally and just like divide the table in half, like little kids divide the room. And I go, you get your half and I get my half. And they didn't play each other's game. And I'm like, that's totally counter to the what we're trying to do here. But they're adults and I can't, you know, I can't change their behavior. But other designers took it literally. Okay, I'm going to be at my table half the time and half the time I'll be out playing other people's games. And hopefully what you have a scenario is you're playing your game with another designer, maybe two, but it's a four-player game. Most of them you want to test at 3-4 players. You want to just test 1v1. Mm-hmm. That's not as good as a test. And so if there's lots of players milling around, now I have myself, I have one other designer, and I have two players we glommed onto. Now we have a four-player game. It gets to the table. I'm making good use of my time, and I'm getting feedback from another designer in addition to regular players. When I went to Unpub is a big unpublished game thing on the West Coast, on the East Coast. It's the biggest there is. They have thousands of people come over 3 days to test unpublished games. And for Unpub, if I was at my table, I could run tests. I mean, I felt bad like going to the bathroom or getting food because there were so many players milling around looking to play games.
Right.
And for me, if I had a 6-player game, I could get 6 players like immediately to play that game. And that was useful for a different respect is that I could take a game and I could run, you know, 10 tests of it back to back and I could just do a whole bunch of tests. So that's useful for a late stage game. Mm. So if you have a game where you just need to run a bunch of tests and see, are there any edge scenarios I forgot? Let's say in this game, you can shoot the moon. How often does that happen? How often can someone shoot the moon? I need to run 20 games and see if someone can shoot that moon in the 20 games. It's very useful, that kind of environment with just players, to run a whole bunch of games to polish a late stage game. But if the game is middle or early and you're still developing it, it's really the feedback you get from other designers is much more useful for leveling up or developing that game.
Absolutely. So is there no West Coast Unpub event?
Not yet. Mm. So there was no Protospiels on the West Coast either. Mm. So I flew to Austin and I went to Protospiel Austin. I flew to Houston and went to Protospiel Houston. I went to Protospiel Prime up in Michigan. And so I'd flown halfway across the country to take my games to these.
Right.
And then I did the first exposure playtest hall at Gen Con and I went to Unpub. And at these events, people are like, I'm from California too. They're like, Right. I'm like, is there any event like on the West Coast, like in Seattle or anything like this? Like, no, there isn't any of them. And so I met James Mathey, who runs Minion Games. And Mathy's quite a character and fun to talk to. And he started poking me. He's like, well, you should run one out there. You're out there and I've seen you at a whole bunch of these. You know how this works. You should run one out there. And I'm fortunate that I have game companies here in the Bay Area who were willing to support it. And Aldo of Impressions Distribution was out here and he was willing to support it and encourage his clients to support it. And so I said, okay, I'm going to try doing one. And so 3 years ago, I did my first one, having never done one before. And I tried to borrow the best ideas from Protospiel Houston, where I stole the idea of a design contest. Mm-hmm. We have a game improv contest.
That was fun.
Having snacks on hand, I stole that from Protospiel Austin. Trying to get a lot of players in addition to the designers, which I stole from Unpub. And so try to take those best elements and put them together. And I made a lot of mistakes the first year. And I have a public blog. So I put up all the lessons I learned and the budget. The budget's public too. Exactly. I lost $50 the first year, which is not too bad.
No.
$16 the second year. And then this year I was positive. I think we're about $200 in the black. So like, woo!
Excellent.
For the first time. So that's good. So that means I can buy some more signs for next time. And so I ran the first Protospiel out on the West Coast for a long time. And since then, that has encouraged other people to do similar, smaller events out here. So Luke Laurie runs like a Protospiel inside a con, like a mini Protospiel inside some conventions a couple times a year. DendriCon did one. CelestisCon did one. PacificCon is doing one this year. These cons are learning that one of the things you want is you want people who run events at your con. So the players can come and find things to do. And you need to have enough things to do. And if they offer a room for game designers to come, those game designers will come set up the room, teach people games, run the whole room. All the con has to do is provide a room. And now they have another attraction for people to go do things for very little cost. And so more and more cons are doing like a prototype room or a prototype zone within the con.
So how do you manage to get more players than designers? What is the technique there? Is it just where you advertise or the, I don't know, you had it in a game store. Is that how you do it?
That helps a lot. And my host location all three times has been Gamecastle, two different locations, and they've been a great host. Here in Silicon Valley, we have lots of tech companies, we have lots of VC money, and that inflates the cost of meeting the space.
Yes, it
does. It like crazy high. So Unpub, the Daryl who runs Unpub was kind enough to tell me what he paid for the Baltimore Convention Center. He said, here's kind of what I paid and what they charged me. And then I asked, when I went to Houston, Kevin Nunn, who runs Houston, how much did you pay for this hotel conference room? What did it cost you? And my cost is literally triple to quadruple what their cost is here in California for the same space.
Right.
It's insane. So I would not have been able to have as many designer tables available or have it as affordable if I didn't have that partnership with Gamecastle. And they, in turn, helped drove a lot of people. They were telling, they would put flyers up in the store,
yep.
And the employees are very supportive because a lot of people who are coming are local game designers who are published, who the game store sells, and they come and they do release events in the game store and help promote their games. And so they're kind of like the home team, like, oh, we want to help the home team make better games. And so they did a very good job of help promoting it and drawing players in.
Great.
And then I'm on Meetup. I have a Meetup group. And I use the Meetup and I cross post a bunch of other Meetup groups to draw people in. That's an Eventbrite. Eventbrite is this website where you go to discover free or paid events and get tickets. It's on Eventbrite. I paid for some ads and some podcasts. I put it up on Board Game Geek. I put it up on Reddit. I put it up on the Board Game Designers Forum.
Mm-hmm.
I had an email campaign each year and wrote out to a bunch of people. And then I would go visit a bunch of game nights and take flyers and cards in the area and say, hey, come on down to Portispiel. And then we make it a value proposition for the players. These players like to play board games. And like, hey, we're going to have tons of games to choose from. You can walk around and pick things that are interesting to you
yep.
and learn to play. And if the game gets published, you already know how to play. You don't have to read the rules. And you get to have a hand in developing that game. This game designer really wants to hear from you. They want you to play their game. And you're doing something useful with your gaming time. You're not just playing a game. You are helping make this game better. You are doing something productive with your time. So people feel a little intrinsically rewarded for that. And then I have some basic rewards that we have, like free snacks. The second year I actually did meals. I provided 6 meals. And that was a ton of work and cost. I probably won't do that again. I'll stick with snacks.
Right.
So we provide snacks and then raffle prizes. We use some of our budget and what we charge the game designers in addition to the sponsors very generously kicked in a bunch of raffle prizes. And we raffle off these games to the players as a thank you for coming. So I get to win games, I get to play games, and I get to eat snacks. And that's like, hopefully and I get to do something useful, make that game better. Hopefully that's gamer paradise right there.
Yep, it was great. All right, we are just about out of time. Before we go, do you have maybe one more tip for new developers? It doesn't have to be about playtesting. It could be about anything.
My number one tip is to work on more than one game.
Yes.
Even if you have your passion game, you know, I really want to make a game about snowplows. That's what I really want to do. You should still start a second game that isn't your passion game
yep.
because the lessons you learn with the second game and having one to go back and forth will make the snowplow game or your passion game better. So even if you say, well, I only ever want to publish my passion game, you should still do a second game or a spinoff game because what you learn from that will make your passion game better.
Right. Okay, great. I think that's going to do it. Thank you again for coming on the show, Jeremy.
Glad to do it.
Where can our listeners find you? What kind of
you can find me on the Board Game Business Podcast, which is just the business side of board games, production, contracts, what's CMYK versus RGB color, what goes in the back of your box, all that stuff. It's at boardgame.business.
Yep.
And you can find my website for Portispiel and the blog where I put up some game design articles that interest me at boardgamebuilders.com.
Excellent. So you can find me at gamelawyerblog.com and go on iTunes and give us a 5-star review. So I will see you all next month.